statements also at Pacifica.org. The station depends on your vote and your involvement in the process. KPFT is required to reach a quorum and must do so to move forward. If you feel you should have received a ballot by now but haven't, contact our election supervisor, Natalie, at kpft-les@pacifica.org. Thank you again for your support of KPFT Houston and for your vote in the 2015 local station board election. Hi, Dwayne Bradley here. When you support KPFT as a listener member, you get a great feeling that comes with contributing to keep your independent local community radio station on the air, and you also have the right to vote in the election of our board members.
To Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm Mike Koenig. I'm on the air with my engineer, Egberto Willis, who has his own show, Politics Done Right, or PDR, Thursdays from 3 to 4 p.m. And, of course, I also encourage you to listen to Partisan Gridlock with Jeff Berg, who does a great show Fridays from 3 to 4 p.m. Well, tonight I have a guest, which is kind of unusual. We will be taking phone calls later, but my guest is David W. Brown, a freelance writer whose work appears in Vox, the New York Times, and The Atlantic. He is a co-author of the book Deep State, which is an exploration of the security apparatus of the U.S., and also author of The Command, the first book to shine a light on the Joint Special Operations Command. I don't normally do current events. I figure that everybody else is kind of saturating the airwaves with current events stuff, so I generally try to do something a little different. In this particular case, the attack on Paris is just so massive and so tragic and so important from a historical and geopolitical perspective that it's something I really wanted to discuss, and I want to discuss it perhaps from perspectives that are not being talked about in the other media, which is something I like to try to do. I've talked before about how warfare, conduction has or conduct has changed since the Second World War. The last time, as far as I know, that any country declared war was in 1945, I think, when the Soviet Union declared war on Japan. I think that was it. And since then, we've been fighting these wars that seem to not come to conclusions. They seem to drag on for years or even decades. And, of course, now we've gone from a draft force to all-volunteer forces, so we're talking about much smaller forces and the political ramifications of, well, they're volunteers. And I have been of the opinion for a while that something fundamental has changed in the way nations conduct their military affairs, and that change, you know, war is horrible, but in some ways I think it's made war worse. So I invited David on the show, and he was kind enough to take some time out from his really jammed up, deadline-filled schedule, and I really appreciate that. David, are you with me?
I am, yes.
How are you doing tonight?
Doing very well. How are you?
Fine, thanks. So, I'm going to start off with you on this. I think you know my opinions on the fact that the absence of a declaration of war has fundamentally changed conduct and outcomes, and the notion of an all-military force which can be used more or less indiscriminately, because they always say, well, they're volunteers. It's not like they were drafted. And all of these political and geopolitical and societal ramifications. I think one of the most ironic headlines I've seen is France, or I think it was Holland, declares war, or something to that effect, without actually declaring war. And how significant is that? The fact that they've already been bombing these people, and now it's like all of a sudden they're thinking, oh yeah, we're at war. How can you bomb people and not figure that they consider themselves at war with you?
Well, we've seen that for really since 2001. And in fact, with respect to combat against ISIS, we saw just a month or so ago when a Delta Force operative was killed in a raid against ISIS. And the Department of Defense wouldn't even go on the record and say that he was killed in combat. They
really
didn't want to call it a combat operation because that has all sorts of legal and political ramifications.
Even though he was monetary.
Shot by the bad guys, we can't call that combat. It's sort of a mad state of affairs.
There are also veterans benefits to be considered for someone who has been killed in combat.
Sure.
So it's monetary as well. I guess the thing that comes to mind for me is we have fought wars, and other Western powers have fought wars in faraway places like Korea, like Vietnam, and it seems like we simply expected that just because we were fighting a war over here, that they wouldn't try to bring the war to us. And Korea did not. And Vietnam, to my knowledge, did not. And it's like all of a sudden we're fighting in the Middle East, and we've been doing that for almost 15 years. And all of a sudden it's like, wow, they found a way to bring the war to us. How dare they? That's kind of how I'm feeling about this. It's like, why are we shocked that we've been bombing and attacking people, and now all of a sudden, because they found a way to bring the war to the West, we're appalled?
Well, I would counter that by saying, when we talk about war, there are certain, obviously, laws of war that are recognized by the international community, whether it's with respect to who you're targeting. So in the case of France, okay, they had bombed Syria previous to the tragic affairs of the 13th, but they weren't indiscriminately. They didn't walk into a concert hall and gun down innocents in cold blood. I mean, to a certain extent, if ISIS wants to put on uniforms and invade Fort Bragg, that's an entirely different situation from blending into the crowd and blowing themselves up in a Walmart, for example. Really, the history of civilization and what we've considered war since there's been civilization no longer applies when we're fighting against what really amounts to sort of a barbaric force. I mean, there's no other way to describe it.
What would be your definition, let's say, for lack of a better word, of asymmetric warfare, which is essentially what, from ISIL and or Daesh or whatever you want to call them, from their point of view, they're fighting. They're fighting an asymmetric war from an apocalyptic perspective. So, I mean, there's that. They really want the whole world fighting there. Asymmetric warfare, if you can't equal your opponent's power, military power, you have to find other ways of discouraging them from attacking you, which violate the Western laws of war. But, I mean, what do you do? What in asymmetric warfare, what would an opponent do? Let's not talk specifically about ISIL, but how do you conduct asymmetric warfare if you're at such a disadvantage in distance and military power?
Well, when we talk about asymmetric warfare, what we're really talking about is simply a sort of an employment of tactics. The United States could, against some sort of hypothetical technologically superior power, could conduct asymmetric warfare. It simply means our technology is not as good as their technology. In the case of, say, Afghanistan or Yemen would be a good example against the USS Cole. They had essentially a raft and a bomb, and they blew up a battleship. I mean, that's asymmetric warfare. That really doesn't get into the areas of, say, mass beheadings or mass graves or gunning down, 100 children, as we saw only a few weeks ago. Asymmetric warfare simply means they have different levels of technology. It doesn't mean weaponizing a civilian airliner and crashing it into a building. I mean, that's certainly an act of war, but I don't think anyone would consider that warfare as it's traditionally known.
And yet, not disagreeing fundamentally, and yet during World War II, what was fought was ultimately called total war, where while bombing civilians was considered against the laws of war, at some point civilians became targets because they manufactured war materiel, because they supported the troops from the home front, and anything that, and I'm going to use this term advisedly, inconvenienced civilians at the home front was considered a legitimate target in order to hobble the enemy war effort. So we've done that. You know, we leveled Dresden with firebombs, and during the war, the Germans and the Allies both were bombing each other's civilian targets, partly for terror reasons, partly in order to impede military manufacturing and capability. So from that kind of a historical perspective, while we think of this as a horror, what are they doing that's different from what the Allies did and the enemy and the Axis did during the Second World War, considering the civilians were legitimate targets for various military logistical reasons?
From a very, you know, from a strict political science point of view, World War II was a war between states. Okay, there was the state of Japan and there was the state of the United States, and we went to war. And at some point, one person was going to surrender or conquer. In the case of World War II, we conquered Japan, and we more or less dictated how their next constitution would be. I mean, we became their dictator for quite a while. In the case of a war against a terrorist army or a terrorist, let's say a terrorist organization, all of those rules really go out the window. All of the pre-existing concepts go out the window. If ISIS were to launch some sort of massive terrorist invasion of the United States, or let's say what happened in, God forbid, what happened in Paris 2 days ago happens every, you know, over the next 4 or 5 weeks, okay, a sustained combat-type offensive, what's their end game? Are they trying to conquer France? I mean, they can conquer France. And when France fights back, are we against the state of Syria? I mean, they are not, or not yet. What are the objectives here? In the case of ISIS, the objective is simply to sow terror and incite political change. I mean, that's the definition of terrorism. In the case of France, they're simply trying to kill these people who are trying to incite political violence. So it's very difficult to compare the two. Except to say what type of organizations are leading these efforts and what are the end games?
Well, I would argue, and it depends on how you want to evaluate the Islamic State, I think that either A, they want to engage as many Western powers in this battle as possible. That would be the apocalyptic ambition that they might have. Or if they're sort of sane in terms of Western thought, they would be trying to get the French to withdraw because the price at home would be too high. So that would be potentially one of two objectives they might have, more engagement or disengagement.
Well, I mean, there are a couple, you know, areas we can jump off from that, but I mean, we found out earlier today that the whole reason the French actually got involved in this conflict in the first place is because they had decisive intelligence that said an attack's coming, you guys need to do something. And they needed to go on the offensive. That was the purpose behind that. It wasn't like the French had been occupying ISIS-controlled Syria or some territory in Iraq. And
they've been bombing them. I mean, it's not like they haven't sort of made an impression.
Right, but that's a very recent event in response to a very specific set of intelligence findings.
They've been bombing Iraq. Now, Syria is new, but they've already been flying sorties in Iraq.
The French?
The French. They have a dozen planes down there.
I'm unaware of a French military offensive in Iraq. If it's against ISIS recently, certainly it's unrelated to the war in Iraq that the United States just fought. I mean, they're adamantly against that.
They have, according to my reading, which I've tried to provide links on the show announcement tonight, I think that it said that they've flown in the last few years something like 200 sorties. And, of course, a sortie is one plane doing one mission. About 200 sorties in Iraq, but have done pretty much nothing in Syria until after the Paris attack, which now they're bombing Raqqa.
Now, are these, are these bombing missions? Are these reconnaissance missions?
No, these are bombing missions. They've done combat sorties with their dozen aircraft, which doesn't sound like a lot, but for some countries that's a whole air force. And they have, I wish I had the article in front of me. I got four articles in front of me, and I don't think that that information is in any of them. But they have, I think, half a dozen fighters. I think they have like five fighters and five fighter bombers and two aerial coordination vehicles.
And I would assume this is in conjunction with NATO. Let me ask you this. I mean, what's the argument here? Is the argument here that ISIS is justified?
Well,
and what they did 2 days ago?
No, it is not, although from their perspective, they might feel it is. I think what I'm trying to drive at, my overarching notion here, is that we really have to look back at how we have conducted, how we have politically managed wars in the past, declaration of war versus not a declaration of war, just going in and doing stuff. Doing little wars or, basically little wars as opposed to like a Texas Hold'em situation where you're all in or you're out. You know, we do these little wars that drag on for years and years because no one power has the political or military will or capability to go in and just finish it one way or the other. And I think also this situation where sometimes we are not fighting states. Although, obviously, they have to have a physical capability somewhere, but the states themselves may or may not be involved. The Islamic State is kind of a different deal, though, because in many ways, we don't recognize them as a state, and their borders are still poor, are still malleable. But, I mean, in many ways, for practical purposes, they're a state. They have territory, they have a population, they have a tax base, they have oil fields. How are they not a state, except that we don't call them that?
I would be very hesitant to call the territory that ISIS controls really in any way a state, certainly not a state that's in any way stable. We're talking about territory they may have owned for a matter of weeks or months.
This True
is
enough.
Something. This is certainly – they don't have defined borders.
But it's something new.
That's going to be step one. You have to have defined borders if you want to call yourself a state. And what they have right now is area that they control by way of militia, by way of intimidation. But, I mean, it's inconceivable to say that the territory they control today could be drawn on a map and would definitely be their territory tomorrow. That's very difficult. That would be a very difficult statement to argue. But to that end, I would say with respect to, say, formal declarations of war, or let me put it to you like this, total warfare versus what we've been fighting.
Limited warfare.
The United States certainly, I'm sorry, do we have to go to a commercial?
Let me do a quick break. You're
sure.
Listening to, thank you so much. You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm Mike Koenig. My engineer is Egberto Willis, who has his show Thursdays from 3 to 4, Politics Done Right, a.k.a. PDR. And my guest, which I'm always excited to have, is David W. Brown. He's also written under the pseudonym D.B. Grady, which he doesn't use anymore, but in order to find some of his writing, you might need to use it. He's a freelance writer whose work appears in Vox, The New York Times, The Atlantic, has co-authored a book called Deep State, which I've read, which is a very interesting book, and also has authored a book called The Command, which shines a light on Joint Special Operations Command. So, I'm sorry, David, go on with what you were saying. We were talking about statehood and what constitutes statehood and declarations of war and that kind of thing.
Certainly. I mean, okay, when you get right down to it, the question is, does anyone, and this doesn't touch on the question of a formal declaration of war with respect to any nation, but I'll use the United States specifically because that's the political system that I'm most familiar with. When we talk about total war, we can say, did we want to end Iraq, for example, the way we ended World War II, the way we ended the war in Japan. That's a very thorny question. I mean, we definitely won Japan, and after that war, after the atomic bombs went off, Japan said, "We're done, no problem."
Well, okay. Actually, the end of the war with Japan was a very different thing from the end of the war with Germany. While we claimed that it was an unconditional surrender, it really wasn't, because their sole demand was we let them preserve the emperor, which we did. We did not disband their infrastructure. We actually utilized it. And a lot of those differences are the reason that Germany has worked so hard to make reparations and to accept responsibility for the Nazis, whereas the Japanese still tick off most of East Asia because they really kind of don't teach their role or admit to their role in the Second World War. So I think that the way we might have conquered Iraq, we might have used the conquest of Japan more as a political model, and we didn't.
Right, but to get to that point, there was a definite period at the end of that sentence, okay?
Okay.
And it was mushroom clouds over major Japanese cities. The question is, did we want to see that at the end of Iraq? And the answer is no, we didn't.
You mean nukes?
Right.
Well,
right.
No,
or,
let's...
Or some sort of...
We had a surrender. We had a surrender. And at the end of that surrender, there were, in fact, conditions set by the Japanese, which we were willing to accept. And then we essentially co-opted the Japanese political and military hierarchy and molded it into a shape that we liked better. And that could have been a model for how we ultimately occupied and managed Iraq. It's just not. We didn't do that.
I'm just not entirely convinced that to get Iraq to a position where they would have accepted any sorts of terms or where we could have gone to the table with those sorts of terms, I'm not entirely convinced that we were willing to do what it took to do that.
And, it would have taken more troops.
What's that?
It would have taken more troops. It would have taken a more substantial occupation.
It would have taken more troops and far more savage and brutal killings. I mean, it would have been, we would have had to not only defeat their army, but we would have had to break their people. And we weren't willing to do that. I think there was an expectation that they would see freedom and they would say, hey, this is pretty great. I want a McDonald's too. And everybody, and like they said, there would be roses in the street.
But the military people at the time, when this war was being planned, had said that we would need like 300,000, 500,000 troops, not only to defeat them, but to occupy them and properly manage them and govern. And it was, I think, primarily Rumsfeld who said, no, we don't have the political support. We want to make it a quick war and get out, and they'll welcome us, as you say, as liberators, and we're going to do it with the minimum number of troops. So it was actually Rumsfeld who overruled the military and their idea of what it would take to really occupy and properly manage, govern, and make a transition for Iraq into what we would hope would be a more friendly, viable sort of democratic state. At least that's my recollection.
And I think that's a great point, and I think it pivots directly into where we are today. One reason that Rumsfeld was so adamant that this was going to happen, not only because of sort of neoconservative notions of how the Middle Easterners would accept sort of Western democracy, but more to the point with respect to military power, Rumsfeld very quickly got on board with the idea of special operations forces being able to go into a country and operate in very small, fast, effective combat situations, kill specific people, sort of surgical warfare at a ground level, let's say. And for a very long time, that was a very effective strategy in a lot of places, and including Iraq, in circa 2006-2007. It took a long time to put that infrastructure into place, but they got very good at that. Delta Force especially really owned that country for a very long time. The problem is it takes a long time to get to that level, and we have sort of in the United States overall, we have a very skewed picture of what special operations forces can do. We kind of see them all as Rambo supermen who can pretty much go into a place and do exactly what you see in the movies, which is not the case. They're very good at what they do. They're the best in the world at what they do. They're extraordinary men of incredible heroism.
They're almost superhuman when you watch what they can do.
Right. But they're not superhuman.
No.
Almost being the key word. So
they're Olympic level
today,
humans in military terms.
In Syria with special operations force. That's one of the things we saw in the Democratic debate last night. The special operations was an easy go-to. Well, I wouldn't put boots on the ground, but I would send special forces in there to do it. Well, that's not going to do it. That's not going to win a war. That's just going to end up getting special operations forces killed or end up stirring up more trouble. You can't win a war like that. You can't change the course of human history like that. It's very rare where you can surgically kill people and win a war or do this with clean hands. If we're going to fight a war, we have to fight a war. And the fact is, we're not willing to fight a war.
Again, this is what I said a little earlier, where when you fight a war, you have to. I think that there needs to be a decision. If you're going to fight a war, you're all in or you're out.
I agree 100%. I think most people would get on board with that. Here's the problem.
But we don't do it. Western powers do it.
If we're going to lay a declaration of war before Congress and say, guys, vote on it, we're going to do this for real. If you're the president of the United States, you're saying, I'm now going to give up 75% of my power with respect to this war. Congress doesn't want that responsibility because then they have to answer to voters for it. The president doesn't want to give up his power. So what we have right now in the United States, and what we've had really for the last, I would say at least since the Vietnam War, but very specifically post 9/11, we have had a political class that has failed us at fundamental levels. Both parties, two branches of government, have said either we want too much power or we want no power at all. We want to do what we want, but we don't want to have to answer for it. That's why Special Operations Forces are so appealing for, say, President Obama. He can fight wars. He can have people killed. He doesn't have to answer to anybody because it's all classified, and you can't talk about that. You're not allowed to know that. That's why Congress allows these sorts of things to happen. That's why Congress doesn't mandate declarations of war. That's why when we look at the authorization for use of military force, it's being used right now to fight ISIS, okay? It's the same authorization for use of military force that was put in place post 9/11 to fight Al-Qaeda. Now, what the argument is, well, ISIS is sort of a branch of Al-Qaeda. That's not true.
No.
They're not allies. Al-Qaeda is fighting a war against ISIS. These are bitter enemies. So how can we say that the same justification for fighting this one, let's call them, quote-unquote, an army, also applies to their enemy? It does not.
I want to read one quote from an article that was in The Atlantic by Oraleen Breeden, Kimiko DeFreitas Tamora, and Catherine Benhold, called Hollande Calls for New Powers to Eradicate ISIS After Paris Attacks. And the question, of course, is what is the United States going to do? Are we now talking about boots on the ground in a big way? And in the article, it says, the United States has provided logistical support for the French airstrikes in Syria, but Mr. Obama on Monday again ruled out a ground intervention, quote, let's assume that we were to send 50,000 troops into Syria, he said at the G20. What happens when there's a terrorist attack generated from Yemen? Do we then send troops into there or Libya, perhaps? And this talks to the slippery slope of this amorphous sort of enemy that we're fighting, which I think goes again to the bigger question of we really need to take a serious look at what war means in the 21st century, how we should conduct it, whether we should have declarations of war or some variation on declarations of war, how troops should be used, whether we should use professional armies or at some point we should do what they did in olden times, which is take this professional corps and then add conscripts to it. I mean, I think these are all legitimate questions that are not being addressed, that need to be addressed in a big way, and I think time to address them is running out before we seriously screw things up. I'm going to do a quick station ID, and then if it's okay with you, David, I'm going to start taking some phone calls.
Bring it.
Okay. You're listening to Think Wing Radio on KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm Mike Koenig. My engineer is Egberto Willis, who does his show between 3 and 4 on Thursdays, Politics Done Right. And my guest is David Brown, who is a freelance writer and co-author of the book Deep State, which is about the security apparatus of the United States, and also author of The Command, the first book to shine a light on Joint Special Operations Command. And I will be adding links to my show announcement after the show in order to make it a little easier for you folks to find those books. Okay, our first caller that we're going to take, and we do have open lines now. We're going to stick to the topic more or less. The phone number is 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. And my first caller is Jerry, who's been on the phone for about 27 minutes, just waiting for this moment. You're on the air, Jerry. How you doing?
Yeah, I'm doing okay. Yeah, I think it's a good topic. Good reason to have a guest on and all that. And it's good to have somebody that actually has some direct experience at that, too. But, no, what I was going to say is actually I've been reading some stuff by Martin Van Creveld, and he says some... You know, he basically sits there and goes, you know, he kind of like derides even the concept of laws of war. And he sits there and has a number of other criticisms, but he.
If you don't have laws of war, what you have then is barbaric chaos. Not that war isn't barbaric, but it can be a whole lot more barbaric, as ISIL Daesh has shown us.
Yeah. What I think is that, you know, I think that, you know, basically combat has become a direct, and this is something that, there's a book out about this, I don't remember the title or the author, but basically the guy kind of posits from what I've been able to gather from what little I've read of the book that, in essence, combat itself has become a direct branch of politics. In other words,
always has been.
You know, if you want to achieve a specific political end, you don't just fight up to a certain point until you set up the political situation or set up the environment for the political situation you want. You just go out and fight, and you know, you expect the political situation you want to result from the combat itself.
Well, David, who's the writer that said that war is simply diplomacy by other means?
Well, Clausewitz said that war is politics by other means.
Politics by other means.
And everything. That's what Clausewitz said. But and that's what this guy is saying, in essence, is that basically, in a certain sense, Clausewitz has been turned over on his head in modern warfare, basically over, you know, in essence, since, like you said, since the end of Vietnam War.
Well, let me ask you a question. Do you have a specific point you want to make to David that he can respond to?
I don't know. I just think that, you know, it's hard to nail down the socio-political things that, you know, it seems to me like whenever we went in, you know, I'll make the same point that I made before a couple of times on the air. In essence, it seems like once we fought in Iraq and everything on the second go around, we went in there and we booted Saddam, or, you know, we got rid of the guy and everything. It seems to me like something fundamentally changed in the Middle East and basically North Africa and everything. It seems like something fundamentally changed, and everybody decided that, you know, basically, like I've said before on the air, it seemed like it became a free-for-all.
Well, I think, I've said before, I think that this is just another stage in the 100-year war that started in 1914 when everything just changed, and
you know,
we really haven't
true.
Sorted that out.
I don't think that's true, because if that were true, then you would be seeing the same thing in Europe and the United States. You don't, at least not yet.
I'm going to ask.
You might be right, but the problem is it hasn't arrived here yet.
Let me ask David a question. I appreciate you calling, Jerry,
yeah,
but because we have a guest, I'm going to try to conduct this a little differently today.
Yeah, I don't want to hold up.
Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks. Bye-bye.
What do you think, David, of that notion that I have occasionally posited, that really what we are in is a 100-year war that started in 1914, and with the breakup of empires, we just really haven't sorted out borders and things yet?
Well, I mean, there's probably something to that. A 100 years is a long time, and we've
had 100-year wars.
114. Pardon?
We've had 100-year wars in history. I mean, there are wars named 30-year wars and the 100-year wars. And really, you know, what peace is sometimes just called war with intermissions. And maybe that's kind of what we're experiencing as the fallout from this massive change in the geopolitical situation that occurred after 1914.
It's interesting that you said war with intermissions. That's when I first joined the Army. There were some young privates in my platoon who were really gung-ho and ready to go to Afghanistan, and they were they weren't part of the deployment that I went on, and a lot of them were kind of upset, like they were going to miss this great war. And,
yeah.
and a very senior NCO in my company pointed out that, look, even if you don't end up going to Iraq or Afghanistan, which you probably will, but even if you don't, wait 10 years. You're guaranteed to go. Every 10 years, we have a different one. And he was right. I mean, he'd been around for quite a few conflicts. So, yes, it does seem like it's kind of a go-to thing, and it always has been a go-to thing, maybe as long as things have been alive. Now, with respect to really once the borders collapsed and the empires began disbanding, have things settled down yet? Maybe not. Maybe we are seeing the repercussions of that. And that applies interestingly to 2003 in Iraq. The people of the world, the people of the Western world, certainly the free world, has to ask themselves, are we happier when one tyrant is suppressing and torturing one nation, but they stay in their border? Are we okay with that, but not okay when the mess spills out? Who are we willing to see sacrifice? I saw an interesting point earlier today where someone said, look, when the sort of President Obama ignored the red line that he himself set and children in Syria were attacked and killed with chemical weapons, we didn't really worry too much about that. But now we're terribly worried about the Syrian refugees. Well, we have to ask ourselves again, when are we happy with the suffering? Are we happy with the suffering when it's their problem and not happy when it was our problem? Or do we have to sort of take a more broad view of the situation?
I think that it was either a U.S. president or a U.S. secretary of state who described, I think it was Somoza in Nicaragua at the time, that he's a son of a bitch, but at least he's our son of a bitch.
Right.
And that
problem is when it's when it's a son of a bitch who's not ours, and that was kind of the situation with Saddam Hussein,
yep.
Obviously.
Okay, let me do a quick ID so I don't have to do one for a little while. You're listening to KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. I'm Mike Koenig. This is I've got Egberto Willis on engineering, who does his show Thursdays 3 to 4, Politics Done Right. And my next caller is Gary. Gary, you're on the air. How you doing tonight? Have you got something you want to say and then ask David?
Well, I want to point out your earlier discussion. I think you were sort of comparing apples to oranges. You're talking about World War II, where a nation called Japan was all Japanese and a nation called Germany was all German. And now you're dealing with the results of the arbitrary slicing up of the land by the British Empire. And the Japanese weren't fighting each other, and the Germans weren't fighting each other. But the Iraqis, the Sunnis, the Shiites, the Kurds, the Alawites, the Yazidis, the Christians, all of these tribes that have been subjected by Saddam, by the way, there was a certain purpose to the strong man in the Middle East. He kept all these people under control, and as a result of eliminating that control, we have this sectarian violence.
Well, but the reason I brought in World War I is because one of the things that were very heavily considered in the breaking up of the empires was the notion of self-determination, which I think was primarily a Woodrow Wilson thing. And because of that premise, you had countries divided up so that you had ethnic groups as homogeneous as possible, as opposed to subjugated ethnic groups in an empire. And that premise at the end of World War I did not follow into the Middle East when they divided up the Ottoman Empire. And
well,
I think that is the source of some of the problem there.
Well, think about Yugoslavia, okay? There's a reason there's six nations in what used to be Yugoslavia. All right, now we've got Croatia and Serbia and all these various, but that's exactly what they did, and that was part of the cause of World War I, if you remember how it started.
Serbia, Ottoman Habsburg Empire assassination.
But now we've moved on, and the Europeans are pretty much, in their own little area of ethnicity, so to speak. And but that didn't occur in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Iraq and Syria. So you still have
the self-determination was confined to Europe.
Well, yes, but you still have all these ethnic animosities there that weren't taken into account. Look at Syria. You've got 18 different groups fighting each other. Okay, it's not like the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor and we attacked Japan. Now we have everybody fighting everybody. So.
Well, this might be an ideal time to think about peace agreements that renegotiate borders and maybe create new countries, like giving the Kurds a nation, which I think they've earned.
It should have happened. There should be three nations in Iraq.
Well, shoulda, woulda, coulda is not the issue we're discussing here. It's where do we go from where we are.
Bombs.
I'm sorry?
It is not going to happen with bombs.
No, it is not. But I think that in a final resolution, that's something that should be looked at by all the parties involved. Because I have a guest tonight, I want to do this a little differently. So if you have a question for David, go ahead and ask it. Otherwise, I'm going to move on to the next caller.
Yes, could he keep talking? I'm enjoying it.
that's very kind of you. And by the way, I agree completely with your notion of dividing these countries up and that so long as we maintain these arbitrary borders that have been established almost meaninglessly, we're going to continue to have these problems. You're right. Bombs will not fix this.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Gary. Appreciate your call. You know, it's a little harder in Iraq because Iraq still has something like a functioning government. But I think that in Syria, where it's already so subdivided by various groups holding territory, and even to a lesser extent in Iraq, where you have the autonomous Kurdistan and you have the Islamic State occupying significant geographical regions, I think at some point when there is ultimately some kind of political settlement, which there must be, I think that we need, or everybody there really needs to think about different borders.
You know, the situation in Syria that terrifies me, when you just sit down, have a drink, and think about it for a minute, who would we possibly support? Like, once this war starts, it's almost as though we have to go against everybody, because right now, are we going to side with Assad? Are we going to begin flying sorties next to really probably one of the most evil human beings, not only on the earth, but to have ever walked the earth? Is he our friend now? I don't think he is. At the same time, we do have the same goal. We want to eliminate this terrorist cancer that is spreading across Syria.
And really, we have been dealing with this for one reason or another in one way or another since the 1960s or 70s. You know, hijacking aircraft, hijacking cruise ships, all these things go back at least 40, 50 years. It's just now it's reached a whole new scale, and because of technology and weapons proliferation, it's just gotten orders of magnitude worse.
I'm going to tell you one thing that terrifies me about what happened in France, and so many things terrify me, and it really affected me.
It's a terrifying time.
Like since 9/11. But when we look at what happened, I was in France only a couple of weeks ago, and you know, you walk down the city and you sort of drink in, you know, millennia of history, centuries. I mean, Notre Dame was 600 or 350 years old when America was discovered. So we're talking about something very old and very precious and irreplaceable. If these guys could have blown up the Louvre, they would have.
Sure.
If they could have walked down the hallways and set fire to every Renaissance painting, they gladly would have. What is at stake here is beyond even my life, your life, the lives of people we know.
What you're saying is essentially what's at stake is civilization.
Certainly civilization, but more important than that, the elements of civilization that have taken forever since the dawn of time for us to create can be undone in the blink of an eye. And that's what scares me most of all. All it takes is one guy with a bomb to walk into the Louvre and an entire wing can be destroyed. Precious paintings that have taken millennia for humanity to produce can disappear forever. And that terrifies me. This is a cold thing to say, but it's also a true thing. I mean, you and I can be replaced, but the Mona Lisa cannot.
I think that it was De Gaulle who said that the cemeteries are full of indispensable men.
Right.
Quick idea, and then I'm going to get to Amir, who's waited very patiently. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston. We do have open lines, 713-526-5738. My guest is David W. Brown, a freelance writer who appears in Vox, The New York Times, The Atlantic, has co-authored Deep State, a book about the security apparatus of the U.S., and has authored The Command, the first book to shine a light on Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC, as some people may know it. Okay, Amir, I appreciate your having waited. Or not? Did we just hang up on Amir? Or did he hang up? Amir? Okay. Amir, if you're not there, I hope you'll call back. So, I think what you say about in history essentially being at stake, civilized history and the production of civilized history, and what Daesh has shown in the Middle East, in Iraq and Syria, is that they fully intend to destroy anything that does not meet their idea of Islamic. Things going back thousands of years.
I think you're exactly correct. And what they define as Islamic, I think, basically is whatever they don't feel like setting on fire that day. When they run out of matches to burn things down, okay, we're done for the day. When I look at the even going back to when the Taliban first came to power in Afghanistan, this was long before 9/11,
yep.
And I remember hearing a report on NPR about them destroying the Buddha carvings on the sides of mountains. It had been around for millennia, and I just thought at the time, like, you know, we'll never get that back. That's something that, if it exists in photographs, that's all that's left of this thing.
They can reconstruct it, but it's just a reproduction.
Exactly. And that's kind of what we're seeing now. You burn down the Louvre, and yeah, we've got scans of all these things and 1,000 pictures of all these things, but we don't have those things anymore. And that unsettles me at a very fundamental level. And what's at stake here, what the French are going through? Let me just say a thing about the French, if you don't mind.
Sure.
I know we're running out of time here.
Oh, we've got about 12 minutes, so you're good.
I've been writing extensively. That was one of the deadlines that I was working on. After 2003, and really in the sort of the haze of time and history and just the fog of war in general, the French have really gotten sort of a reputation or have sort of been perceived, I think, over time as being really obstructionist to the goals of the United States and some sort of vague, hostile nation to the extent that we would ever fight each other.
The Gaullists threw NATO out of France and started essentially, I use the term advisedly, raiding the U.S. gold reserves, which is why Nixon disconnected the dollar from gold. And yeah, there was a period of time, especially under de Gaulle, where it seemed like they were very much running at interests counter to the United States.
Right. What I find very interesting, especially when we look at the very unique reaction that France had to had to 9/11. I can think of no other country that seemed so profoundly moved and horrified and mortified by what happened. The first foreign leader to fly over Ground Zero was Jacques Chirac, president of France. France, of course, is not a warlike nation, and Chirac was certainly not a warmonger himself. But when it came time for military operations in Afghanistan, which were justified and needed to happen, France was there. Okay, they were by our side, and they weren't fair weather friends. Things went really bad in Afghanistan, really circa 2006, 2007, and not a lot of nations were willing to contribute to what was called a silent surge. The Iraq surge got a lot of press, but Afghanistan also had a surge of 10,000 soldiers and. The United States went to different countries and said, hey, can you guys contribute? And most countries said, no, we're not interested. The things are going bad. They were done. France said, yeah, we're in. We'll help.
The French and the Brits have really been carrying their weight the last 20 years in terms
Certainly.
Of at least from American interests.
Certainly. They France has stood by our side from the very beginning of this. And at the 10-year anniversary of 9/11, I was deeply moved. Across from the Eiffel Tower is Trocadero, and they're It's a symmetric building, and there are two vague tower-like things. And erected there were two twin towers for the 10th anniversary of 9/11 with France. I think France will never forget. and everyone who saw who went on the Eiffel Tower, you know, tens of thousands of people saw that. I mean, they've expressed a solidarity that goes beyond a mere ally to something that's almost a sort of a spiritual, an older brother or a wise older friend. And of course, the United States wouldn't exist without France. They were the key military, political, financial,
but of course, but of course, at that time it was mostly
the
because
Revolution.
They.
I mean,
but of course, at that time it was mostly because they really, really didn't like the British. I'm going to get to Amir now because he called back. Amir, you are on the air. Thanks for calling back. We only have several minutes, so I hope.
Thank you. I'll be quick.
Yes.
My comment was on the fact that you were saying why we don't go in and end all, you know, go all in and, you know, do the job and end the war. And my question, my concern is that if our economy is based on having wars, wouldn't that be to our disadvantage if we end wars? In fact, as you know, Saudi Arabia, all these countries, they're not able to produce any anti-missile for the tanks or guns or ammunition, and they have to buy it from the United States, and Iran is buying through the black market through Israel from the United States. So wouldn't that be to our disadvantage if wars would end?
You know, that's a great question, and I'm going to make a comment, and then I'll let David make a comment. And, okay, so there's no one behind you, so we can keep you on the line for as long as we can. I think, first of all, I've had this discussion. One of the points I made is that money is fungible. And if the money is not to be made in arms, the money will be invested someplace else where it can make money, hopefully in the United States, but wherever. I think there's the morality of an economy built on war. I think there's also the question of, isn't a short, intense war, horrible as it is, in a way more humane than what seems like an eternal, ongoing, low-level war where people just keep getting killed and killed and killed and infrastructure just keeps getting battered and battered and battered? And, I mean, after the Second World War, after a period of recession where the troops were coming home and had to find jobs and had to be incorporated into the economy, we had the biggest boom in American history, economically speaking. David, do you have a comment you want to make on that?
I think your caller is absolutely correct that at some point we've sort of become dependent on this sort of warlike, this sort of wartime economy. And I think there's a great fear. I mean, right now the economy is in some sort of recovery, and I do think there's a tremendous fear that if we interfere with that, what will be the repercussions?
There are things we can build on the cutting edge of technology that don't have to be weapons. I mean, we're just waiting. People like me are just waiting to decide, hey, instead of building warplanes, why don't we go ahead and build spacecraft?
Well,
you know,
I'm
it's not like we don't have the
right
people.
Now, so it's funny that you mentioned that, but... But, yeah, I think when we look at the $1 trillion that have been spent on the F-35 Joint Strike Fighter that has stealth technology that actually can't fight strategically, can barely get off the ground and is not actually stealth, you know, we could have built, I think, something like 250 space shuttles. It's these insane numbers that terrify and mortify.
So we can transition the economy if we had the will. But it's convenient to keep going at this low level of warfare, selling weaponry. And, you know, I'm all for defense. I believe in a strong defense and peace through strength. I don't believe in using this stuff to just kind of have eternal wars all over the place.
No.
All right. Well, I appreciate you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Amir. I appreciate your calling. Okay, we've got one more caller. I think he's probably going to be the last one. Joe, you're on the air. How are you doing tonight?
Yeah, good. I'm going to agree with a lot you said there. You know, the business of government is business, and the best business we have is war. So diverting the money, and this all offers a question, to something back in the space program, like, you know, we did a really good job of developing a plan, complete plan to take solar energy off the moon, capture it and bring it down here very inexpensively. I think the latest numbers I heard is $1 trillion. We'll get it to the entire world.
Well, lunar solar, orbital solar, you know, either plan.
Ryder talked about it a lot. You know, and Dave Criswell's my neighbor down here at Clear Lake, and we talk about it a lot. But you could turn around and get us solar power from the moon, which is really inexpensive compared to other forms of doing it, for $1 trillion. And, you know,
That's a war.
10 years.
One war's worth of solar energy, and basically would be good to go.
And we don't need, you know, Kennedy was ahead of the game by far when he set up the peace program, the Peace Corps, going into countries. And that's where we get the big dividends. You know, if war wasn't our business, that's where we would be. Because that would be another business for us. We'd be creating allies throughout the world, people who would want to do business with us rather than being forced into it.
And customers.
Yes.
And customers.
And friends and people who don't want to kill us.
David, you have any thoughts on all of this, that now we seem to be sort of evolving into another subject at the end of the show here?
I think that would be a lovely situation if it could happen, but I also think, you know, when we look at the world as it is today, I don't think ISIS would really give a damn if we built solar power on the moon.
Yeah, but you know, we created ISIS, huh? That's our
right. Well,
invention.
Right, but what I'm saying is we can't just uncreate it.
Yeah, it's like having a baby. You can't kill the baby.
Deal with it.
I'm sorry. It's like
there.
Yeah, it's like having a baby. You can't kill the baby. You know, we created them, but now we have to deal with them. Okay, Joe, I appreciate your having called, and I hope you'll call again. Thank you. Okay, I guess we're pretty much toward the end now. So, David, is there anything you want to say to kind of try to wrap this up conceptually?
No. The topic has been so broad today that it would be difficult to give a nice, eloquent closing statement. But I would say that, you know, I do believe strongly that we should stand in solidarity with France, which has been that has stood so strongly in solidarity with us. I think it's going to be a messy few years ahead.
I think it's going to be a couple of generations. You know, I've thought about...
It's already been one. It may as well be three.
Well, it's arguably been two.
Right.
I think that if you want to defeat jihadism, ultimately you have to have a younger generation come up that doesn't believe in it, and then the older generation has to die. And that's going to take at least a couple of generations. I think that's what we're in for. Okay, my guest tonight has been David W. Brown, a writer who appears in Vox, The New York Times, and The Atlantic, co-author of Deep State, author of The Command. I'll put links on my site for today's show announcement. Thank you so much, David. I know you've been incredibly busy, and I really appreciate your taking the time tonight.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
All right, you take care. All right, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig here on KPFT 90.1 FM in Houston with Egberto Willis on engineering. I thank you all for listening. I thank the callers, and I will talk to you all next week. And I don't have a quote off the top of my head, so just take care. I'll speak to you later. Good night.
Houston will preempt regular programming on Tuesday, November 17th at 8 a.m. until Wednesday, November 18th at 8 p.m. for our annual celebration of the Pacifica Radio Archives. Hear historical footage, musical performances, speeches, and much more as part of this pre-holiday campaign to protect and preserve unique voices for generations to come. Again, tune in on Tuesday, November 17th at 8 a.m. through Wednesday, November 18th at 8 p.m. for special programming from the Pacifica Radio Archives. You can give to the archives now at supportpra.org. And thanks for listening to 90.1 KPFT Houston.
This is Natalie Ortiz, your local election supervisor. It is now time to cast your vote in the local station board election. You are eligible to vote if you renewed or became a member between August 18, 2014 and August 17, 2015. You should receive your ballot in the mail by November 4, 2015. If you registered in advance to cast your ballot online, you should have received an email with your voting instructions and password. If you did not register in advance for online voting, you can still cast your vote online. Your unique password will be included in your mailed ballot materials along with the online voting directions. All ballots must be received or cast online by 10:59 p.m. Central Time on December 4th, 2015. Please visit the election website, elections.pacifica.org, for more information, or email me, kpft-les@pacifica.org. Thank you.
This is KPFT Houston.